right. Thank you so much. Well, welcome everyone to our November 18th meeting of the Commerce and Gaming Committee. This is our annual committee days, and we have on the docket today a work session. So we'll be hearing some updates from four different panels of people, and I think you'll find us all very interesting. So before we get started, I just need to mention a few of our rules of the road. This meeting today is being recorded and streamed live on TVW and on YouTube. And in terms of participating with our virtual meeting, you'll need to be recognized by me, the chair, before you begin speaking. And for my members, if you want to ask a question or provide comment during the meeting, please use the raise hand feature on Zoom, and that's located on the bottom of your screen. Make sure you keep your microphone muted during the meeting to avoid background noise or any other audio disturbances, and only turn it on when the chair calls on you to speak. And then remember to mute when you're done. And it's not a meeting until at least one person has evoked the phrase, "you're on mute." So just laying that out there. And this meeting will be in active speaker mode for the public as they're viewing it. And so if you're not muted, noise from your microphone will display you as the active speaker. So you probably don't want to do that accidentally. So our presenters, I think, have worked with staff to get their documents all set. If you're presenting it on your own screen, though, please have it open and ready to go. And when you're called on, just turn on your audio and video and begin sharing your screen. Let's see, I think that is everything we need to go over. All right, so I am going to start with our update from the Social Equity in Cannabis Task Force. Our wonderful member, Melanie Morgan, has been chairing that group, and she will be joined with the project manager from Social Equity in Cannabis Task Force, Anjan Slaughter, who is going to help me pronounce her name correctly next.
Anjanay.
Okay.
Anjanay.
And so I have you for 25 minutes. And so let's try to keep an eye on the clock and wrap it up around two. And other than that, please go ahead and start.
All right. Thank you. I want to give room to our chair here, Rep. Morgan, if you have any opening words, and then I'll dive into the presentation.
Thank you, Anjanay. And thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging us to come back to the committee to give you an update on the awesome work that the task force has been tasked to do. And I think that the committee will be well pleased with our presentation on the end result of the recommendations we are now bringing forward. I also want to thank Anjanay Slaughter for diving in the middle of this work, but really pulling it off. And she has a team that works with her now, and that they're really able to work with our task force at large and our subgroups. And so be nice. This is her first time in this role presenting to the legislature, but I think you're going to be excited with her presentation that she has for you. I do want to add just a word of caution to remember that these are recommendations. And so we'll have ample time, I'm sure, to discuss how we turn these recommendations into actual legislative language. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Anjanay Slaughter. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Let me share screen here. All righty, can I just get a head nod or a thumbs up that everyone can see my screen properly? Thank you, perfect. All righty, well, good afternoon, everyone. As mentioned, my name is Anjanay Slaughter. I am the staff manager of the Social Equity in Cannabis Task Force. Today, I'll be updating the committee on the task force work in the following areas around background, public meetings, our work plan, and task force recommendations thus far. So our background, the task force was staffed by the Governor's Interagency Council on Health Disparities. We do have three designated staff members, one manager, myself, we have a policy analyst, and a part-time admin assistant. The Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force is a quasi-legislative task force made up of this perfect balance between legislators and industry experts. There currently are 17 members on the task force, including our chair and member of this committee, Representative Morgan, as well as Representative Kelly Chambers. It's so good to see you, Representative Chambers. All members are appointed jointly by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, as outlined in statute. The task force currently has three vacant seats. Those seats are from the Office of the Attorney General, the seat from the Department of Commerce, and our seat from the Association of Washington Cities. But our legislative staff is aware of these vacancies and they're working to fill those seats as soon as possible. In addition, I also like to note that the task force has one community advisory member who was appointed by the chair and members at large. Alrighty, quick refresher. The House Bill 1443 passed through the legislature during the 2021 session and was signed by the governor on May 3rd with an effective date of July 25th, 2021. The social equity program that came out of that recent legislation states that beginning December 1st, 2020 until July 1st, 2029, cannabis retailer licenses that have been subject to forfeiture, revocation, or cancellation by the board, or cannabis retail licenses that were not previously issued by the board, but could have been issued without exceeding the statewide limit, may be issued to social equity applicants. According to that same statute, an individual is eligible for these licenses if they are one of the three qualifications, if they meet one of the three qualifications. One, they have lived in a disproportionately impacted area. Two, have a drug conviction. Or three, their family has a drug conviction. Additionally, House Bill 1443 also created the technical assistance and mentorship aspect of the social equity program, as well as a few additional responsibilities to the task force that I'll outline now. One of those factors are for the board that they must consider in distributing the licenses currently available for cannabis retailer licenses that are subject to forfeiture, revocation, or cancellation. That's a long-winded way of saying the task force is charged with giving recommendations on how to implement the current program that's outlined in statute. Another responsibility is whether any additional cannabis producer, processor, or retailer licenses should be issued beyond the total number of licenses that have currently been issued. Following the social equity impact of altering residential cannabis agriculture regulations. So this, I'm listing the tasks now that the task force is charged to do, and it's a lengthy list. So I know it's not presented in front of you. I'm really asking everyone to use their listening ears here, but please allow me to continue. The social equity impact of shifting primary regulation of cannabis production from the board to the Department of Agriculture, right? And considering any potential impacts that employment, that might affect employment rights of workers. Furthermore, the social equity impact of removing nonviolent cannabis-related felonies and misdemeanors from the existing point system used to determine if a person qualifies for obtaining or renewing a cannabis license. Additionally, whether to create workforce training opportunities for underserved communities to increase employment opportunities in the cannabis industry, as well as the social equity impact of creating new cannabis license types. And of course, on how to implement this new social equity technical assistance and grant program. But as you can imagine, recommendations from the task force are delivered to the respective bodies in batches as soon as they're passed to the task force so that we can make sure that we are updating relative agencies as they come through. The final report, however, is outlined in statute and that is due December 9th, 2022.
Next slide here. Oops, went through a couple of them.
Okay, and so I just outlined kind of the staff, membership, the purpose, and the timeline. I'm going to move forward to our public meetings. So early on, the task force with the direction of the chair decided to divide the work into three work groups in order to cover as much ground as they could due to the tight timeline and lengthy list of responsibilities. So from there, we've created three work groups. Our work group number one is the disproportionately impacted areas work group, and they're focused on eligibility and prioritization of the current social equity programs that are outlined in statute. The second work group is focused on licensing and the task force responsibilities relative to licensing, i.e. this would be, do we need more retail or producer processor licenses, right? That would be an area in their scope. The work group number three is our technical assistance and mentorship work group, which might come off as a no-brainer. They are focused on the recommendations around the technical assistance and mentorship, as well as any legislative recommendations that might revolve around that program. All work group and task force meetings are open to the public and welcome community feedback and participation. So just to give you an idea of how often we meet, the full task force first convened in October 2020 and since have had 8 meetings to date. The disproportionately impacted areas work group first convened February 2021 and since have met 7 times. Some themes that we've heard from this work group are that due to the limited number of licenses available, licenses need to be prioritized based on those who are harmed by the war on drugs. Additionally, over those 7 meetings, this work group has thought critically about definitions of family, disproportionately impacted areas, social equity scoring rubric, as well as an application process. And following that, we have the licensing work group, first convened April 2021. And since they have met 7 times. Some themes that we're hearing from this work group is that the 39 revoked or canceled licenses that are currently allocated to the social equity program and statute simply is not enough. Instead, the work group and community agreed that true equity would mean that social equity business owners should own 50% of all cannabis licenses issued in the state. Based on this conclusion and other metrics, the work group has drafted proposals to the task force around additional retail and producer processor licenses. In addition to what equity should be, this work group understands that there are some barriers to entry for new licensees. So the work group has worked together to create proposals around these issues as well. And thirdly, we have our technical assistance and mentorship work group. This work group first convened May 2021 and has since met 6 times. Some themes heard in this work group is that the access to capital is the biggest need and barrier for those that are harmed by the war on drugs. To adequately help the individuals, the $1.1 million that is annually allocated for technical assistance grants is insufficient compared to the $500 million in cannabis tax revenue that came to the state in 2021. Additionally, the work group took a close look at the cannabis tax account and appropriations altogether and took the opportunity to propose a new cannabis tax structure to the full task force. Our work plans, and I know I'm kind of downloading a lot of information. Of course, I'm leaving room for Q&A at the end of this presentation. Work plan. So the task force first priority is to offer recommendations to the agencies on how to implement the current social equity program that's already had been passed through our state legislature, right? The second priority, again, is to offer recommendations to agencies, and this agency would be the Department of Commerce, on how to implement the technical assistance and mentorship program, which again has already had funding allocated towards. And then the third priority is to offer recommendations to the legislature. All right, now we get into what are some of those recommendations that have come out. And I know my slides are simplified, so if you guys have questions, I welcome them at the end of these, at the end of my presentation. So some adopted recommendations are around eligibility definitions. Again, the DIA work group took a lot of time in defining and looking into the definition of family and DIA. The work group decided to go with the family definition that was passed by House Bill 2614. This is the paid family leave. In 2020, legislatures, yourselves, lawmakers agreed that family should be defined in a broad sense. The concept behind a broad definition is to be an
as inclusive as possible. This includes capturing members who are non-biological and de facto relatives. The work group agrees that the broad definition of family member that the state, the Washington state, has already passed would be most fitting for this definition when it comes to social equity. DIA is defined through a formula that is rooted in statute. The variables to this formula are the percent of unemployment in these areas, median household incomes as proportion to the county, number of drug convictions, and the nuance that the work group brought to the task force was a coefficient to represent disparities in cannabis convictions. Using this formula, the work group was able to order the disproportionately impacted areas into an index where we can see the areas that are most harmed versus those that are least harmed. Alrighty. In addition to those two recommendations, the Technical Assistance and Mentorship Work Group has offered the recommendation, which passed through the task force, to begin implementing the current mentorship program that's already outlined in House Bill 1443. The Technical Assistance and Mentorship Work Group also proposed the task force, which was passed, to provide financial assistance as an additional use for these cannabis licensees who fit the social equity definition. And furthermore, increasing the current allotment to 10% of the cannabis tax revenue that's currently going into the state general fund. Okay, from that same work group, 5% of the cannabis tax revenue should go towards low interest loans for social equity licensees. Okay. So this is a part, and then additionally, which just passed November 16th, 2 days ago from the task force, is that total 50% of the cannabis tax revenue dollars, 50% of all cannabis revenue that comes to the state should go back into communities, 10% in the form of financial assistance to these social equity applicants, 5% in the form of low interest loans, again, to these social equity business owners, and then the remaining 35% back into programming in the disproportionately impacted areas in areas that have been also impacted by the disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. Okay. From the licensing work group, the task force has heard that, you know, including equity 8 years after legislation has left a lot of room to catch up for individuals who are most harmed by the war on drugs. And therefore, the task force adopted this recommendation that all new licensees should be reserved for social equity through 2029. This includes new license types that haven't been passed through the legislature. This will give those social equity applicants the time to catch up so that we can meet equity in the industry. Additionally, from licensing, we've heard that all social equity licenses, they should be flexible. Again, these are individuals that are coming in to the market 8 years after it's already been legalized. And so there are some barriers to entry. We have buffering issues. We have ban and moratorium issues. This sets up a climate that makes it really hard for these new licensees to get in. And therefore, having the flexibility of those licenses would be beneficial to the new license holders with the permission of the respective jurisdictions, the cities, of course. Additionally, another barrier to entry, again, is that buffer zone. So the work group and the task force see that there is some room to reduce the buffer zones from 1,000 feet to 500 feet reserved for social equity. This would exclude elementary schools and secondary schools, playgrounds. There are next steps. Now, those are what have been adopted from the task force, and that's a lot. That's a lot. The task force has come a long way, but there's still more work to do. Our next step is we have another task force meeting December 14th, where the licensing work group will be able to bring a few more proposals to the task force level. Okay, some of these proposals will look like some city incentives to maybe get those areas to open up that are currently in ban and moratoriums. The licensing work group is preparing to make a recommendation or a proposal around at least 200 new producer processor licenses be created and allocated to social equity license holders between now and 2029. Additionally, they're looking to bring the proposal that a minimum of 300 additional social equity retail licenses be created between 2022 and 2029. Furthermore, they're looking to make an amendment to the original, one of the original recommendations that passed through the task force around flexibility, right? They're looking to bring more flexibility to these licenses so that they can really be set up for success. Again, we have to establish the social equity goal, which is a goal of 50% of all total licenses being owned by social equity applicants. And then lastly, they would like to make an additional recommendation on buffers, to reduce buffers from elementary schools and secondary schools to 500 feet and completely remove the parks and arcades out of that legislation, out of that legislation, that RCW. Okay, and on that note, I will open it up to question and answer, and I can stop sharing my screen. Alrighty, I see. I'm sorry. Chair Kloba, would you like to facilitate Q&A?
Yes, I do. Thank you. You're quicker on the trigger than I am. I couldn't find my microphone. So I see a question from Representative Robertson. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am new to the committee, and so I don't know a lot of the background over the past 8 years. But I'm curious, so 8 years ago when the initial round of applicants, what percentage of the applicants were the DIA classification of applicants, and what percentage of those applicants were approved and licensed, and as well as the other applicants that you speak of that are current licensees, what was the application versus approval percentage, so we can compare those numbers? Just trying to get an idea what the full scope of the issue is, and the justification for holding all these current licenses and any future licenses up to 50% of all licenses for DIA candidates.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Robertson. I think that's a phenomenal question. I do not have that data in front of me right now. What I do have in front of me are the current stats, which is over 80% of cannabis licenses owned in Washington State are by non-individuals who have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. But I would love to follow up once I get that data with you to give you some better context. Thank you.
All right, great. I have a question from Rep. Morgan or a comment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to Anjanae for that great presentation. But I kind of just wanted to add a little bit more to Representative Robertson's question, if I may, Madam Chair. The fact is to remember that why we created this task force to begin with was that there was a disparity, and coming from the war on drugs disproportionately impacted Black and Brown people, locking them up for long sentences that were undue sentences. But now that we've legalized cannabis in the state of Washington, we are still being penalized and not being able to participate in the 51% ownership. So we may not have the actual data that you are looking for. We only can look at that data in terms of what we've collected in our disproportionately impacted subgroup, in that there are communities that have been redlined and that have been purposely pushed out of the industry. And that's why we slowed it down in this committee, so that we could make sure that we were having equity come along on all parts of the industry.
All right, I'm gonna add in there. I feel like this question came up last session. And the thing that is stuck in my mind, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, is that, for instance, race or some of these other aspects of how you would define a disproportionately impacted person or community those are not fields of information that are collected on any of the licensing applications. So it's hard to know what those numbers are because those things were not asked at the time. Am I remembering that right?
Yes, Madam Chair. And it is not the only parts of our economic industries in the state of Washington. We are finding that in every parts of the industries that we don't have this information in order to create a more equitable system and processes. So I think that we will, going forward, I hope that in this committee we can work together to find a way to bring that perhaps online in making sure that we are moving towards inclusion and making sure that everybody in the state of Washington has a chance to participate, especially Black and Brown people who have been excluded from many, many industries in the United States of America.
Yeah, I think we have lots of ways of measure of assessing that, not as cleanly as we might hope. And certainly moving forward, you know, we understand that you can't change what you don't know, and you can't know it unless you measure it. So we have some work to do there. But Robertson, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit of a data dork, so I apologize. And so there's no baseline data is what I'm hearing. So how did we establish the goal of 51%?
Either Anjanae or
Anjanae,
go ahead.
Yeah, I would say the work group, hearing from the work group's discussion, is looking at other states. We really there's social equity programs happening all over the country right now, right? And New York is currently the gold standard, where they set out that 50% of all of their licenses would be owned by social equity applicants. Now, Washington State, why not follow in that same gold standard, especially when we have a lot more history when it comes to legalization of cannabis?
Okay. All right. So do I have any more questions? If not, we can go ahead and move on to our next panel. Thank you so much, Anjanae. I think pronounced it correctly. A little bit of practice. It's a lovely name. I apologize for brutalizing it. Anjanae and Rep. Morgan, thank you so much for the work and for presenting that to us. So we're going to switch gears slightly to the Cannabis Science Task Force, which has been operational for a couple of years now. And I see that we have Dr. Annette Hoffman lined up, ready to go. She's the Environmental Assistant Program Manager in the Department of Ecology, and she chairs the task force. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead. And I think we should be trying to wrap up around 2:30.
Great, thank you. I think I just want to double check, make sure that you can see my screen.
Yes, we sure can. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, Chair Kloba and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Anna Hoffman, and I am the chair of the Cannabis Science Task Force. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you this update. Move my windows around a little bit. What I'd like to do is start with just a brief background to orient us all to where we've been, and then provide you some highlights and takeaways from the first year's work, which is in the first report, and then dive right down into the second year's work that we're doing and the key messages that we have for you. So essentially, the cannabis industry has evolved more rapidly than the science needed to support it. So to provide the consumer protections that we're looking for, cannabis products must be tested for comparison to product standards. Within this evolving industry, cannabis laboratories have had to develop their own testing methods. There have been reports of inconsistent testing results among laboratories, which has reduced regulatory and consumer confidence. So to address this, the legislature sought to make improvements to the cannabis laboratory accreditation process. Now, what is laboratory accreditation? It's an independent third-party process by which a laboratory is certified that it has the right resources needed to do a specific task, that it can use those resources and deliver positive proof of that capability. And I like to think of this as kind of getting a driver's license, where there's a written test to show that I understand the rules of the road, and then there's also a practical driving test that shows that I can actually be competent on the road. Now, the Washington State Department of Ecology has extensive experience accrediting environmental and drinking water laboratories, and the legislature identified ecology with that accreditation expertise as the appropriate body for cannabis. However, it also recognized that there were gaps in order to fill and implement the ecology's program. So in 2019, those were outlined in the House Bill 2052. And with that, the legislature established the Cannabis Science Task Force to help fill those gaps. The first substantial gap identified was in scientifically based and standardized lab quality standards. And the second was to characterize successful proficiency testing. At this point, I think it's worth pointing out that the terms lab quality standards and testing methods as used here really mean the same thing, and I use them interchangeably. Lab quality standards is a term that's written in statute, but testing methods is really the practical application. And we found that in our work that the term lab quality standards is often confused with other kinds of standards like product standards or lab accreditation standards. So just so that you know, I tend to lean on the phrasing testing method because it's more descriptive. So just a little bit about what is ecology's accreditation program. Whereas in the current situation, a lab's proficiency in one area certifies it for a broad scope, with ecology's model, a lab must be certified for demonstration, certified and for and demonstrate proficiency in each specific combination of method, analyte, and matrix. And what does that mean? The method is the testing method or the lab quality standard that we just talked about. Analyte is the substance that you're being tested for, you're trying to find, and matrix is the actual product being tested. So for each of these specific combinations, you see the pillars here. Ecology's model evaluates all of these pillars. That's for each combination. So that is a substantial difference. So does the lab have the necessary equipment, supplies, personnel, and other resources to run the tests for that specific combination that they're seeking accreditation for? Does the lab have the needed sample and data management procedures? Does the lab have the right quality assurance and control procedures to properly implement the testing methods? And has the lab been able to demonstrate proficiency or provide that positive proof that it can put all those things together in a way that provides accurate results in a blind study? Incorporating all of these elements into your accreditation program for cannabis isn't simple, which is why we're here, why the task force was convened. So a little about the task force. It's been a cooperative effort with many bringing important experience, expertise, and authority to the table. There were a total of 42 active participants from 4 different agencies and 9 different cannabis laboratories over the past 2 years. We met monthly. Well, the steering committee met monthly. I'll get to that. We were organized by a charter and a governance structure that included a steering committee and a number of work groups. The task force was chaired by the Department of Ecology. The steering committee included representatives from Ecology, Liquor and Cannabis Board, Department of Health, Washington State Department of Ag, and 3 labs, the Medicine Creek Analytics, Confidence Analytics, and Capital Analysis Group. And that's the group, the steering committee, that has met monthly since the beginning. The work groups met a lot more than that. They included knowledgeable representatives from the agencies and the private labs, and they were convened for each of the fields of testing. One, a field of testing might be something like pesticides or heavy metals. Those were identified in that House bill. And I'd really like to thank everybody who brought their expertise to this important work. How did we function? Our charter laid out how the governance structure would work to develop these recommendations that you see that are in the reports. Over the duration of the task force, members of the work group were chosen by the steering committee, and that was based on their expertise with the subject matter. With this structure, the work groups did the heavy lifting, comparing existing methods, having in-depth conversations about applicability, developing proposed motions for recommendations or for testing methods. And this work was completed in between steering committee meetings. They might have met two or three times a month, depending on their needs and the difficulty of the subject matter. In the work group discussions is where the participating cannabis labs were able to bring forward their own work on testing methods for consideration. And they also looked at other states, what were other states doing? And so a lot of information was brought in at that level. Throughout those discussions, the work groups then formulated motions and presented them to the steering committee meetings, along with the pros and the cons that the work groups discussed. Motions are the recommendations. So this gave the steering committee an opportunity to ask questions, consider private laboratory resources, and deliberate the motions. And at those steering committee meetings, amendments were often made by steering committee members and vetted through the work group leaders. The steering committee members then voted on the motions, and the motions either passed or failed. Sometimes they were sent back to the work groups for revisions or to deliberate other considerations. Because of this process, all the motions brought to a vote passed, and all but one passed unanimously. Other times, the work group discussion stalled because they needed some clarity or guidance from the steering committee. We'll hear a little bit more about that later. In the end, the task force recommendations on testing methods in the reports came from motion proposals that started in the work groups and kind of came up through this, this decision-making structure by this process. So that's a way of some background and how we operated. So let me just dive quickly into some of the key takeaways from the first report. So there's a lot of work to do, and the task force was divided. The work was divided into different fields of testing, and those are there's one report which is at this website address here that's already done, and the other is still will be due in December of this year. So we just have a little bit longer before before it'll be available. The first report addressed laboratory science to test for pesticides in plants and products. Beginning with pesticides gave the task force the ability to draw from current procedures and adapt them to cannabis. We leaned very heavily on United States Department of Ag methods and procedures that were already in place and already had protections built into them. This was a great place to start with because it helped the task force forge a fruitful path and develop a rhythm. And a key theme from this work was the need for some flexibility to enable the science to evolve with the industry. So the recommended science has some flexibility built into it. However, here's the catch to that. That flexibility has a cost associated with it in the form of an ongoing regulatory oversight body. So the theme of the need for the regulatory oversight you'll hear is threaded throughout the work of the task force. The second report, which is due in December, addresses other fields of testing. There's potency, heavy metals, microbial elements, and residual solvents. It also addresses proficiency testing that must be applied to all fields. As with pesticides, the task force relied heavily on already approved agricultural and environmental testing industries and standards. By doing this, we were able to leverage consumer protections that are already built into these methods. We reviewed each of the methods and protocols, recognizing that they needed some adaptations to fit within the cannabis testing system in Washington. There were also a couple of themes that emerged from our work that brought more clarification on how this effort could move forward. A little bit more on flexibility. While the task force began with the notion of flexibility in the first report on pesticides, it was during the potency discussions that different opinions began to obstruct progress towards motions and recommendations. So to help with this, the steering committee drafted guidance on flexibility for the work groups to follow. The guidance was written to be general and not just specific to potency, and largely favored prescriptive methods that were amenable to regulatory and accreditation needs. But it did allow for some flexibility to support creative work. The second theme was on proficiency testing. So we use a shorthand PT for proficiency testing. So if I just say PT, that's what I mean. So a proficiency test is a study where an independent provider sends samples of products with known quantities of a chemical to laboratories. The way it works is that the chemical quantities are only known to the PT provider and they're blind to the laboratory. Passing a PT or proficiency test integrates all of the accreditation pillars and demonstrates that the lab provides that positive proof that the lab can follow the method correctly and produce accurate results. An essential element in this report is the Cannabis Science Task Force recommendation that the proficiency tests must be in cannabis when testing for pesticides, potency, or residual solvents. What that means is that hemp is not a suitable alternative for those fields of testing. And at this point, I just want to put on my ecology hat and say that ecology agrees with this recommendation. Although the task force was unable to identify a technical solution where hemp could be used as a surrogate for cannabis-based proficiency tests, the work group did take a step toward looking for a solution. They described the needs of a cannabis-based PT program or study, and then designed a trial experiment to try to understand the logistic and other barriers. Through this effort, they realized that control mechanisms, for example, licensing or the traceability requirements, presented the barriers that they were not able to overcome, but at least they were able to identify those. Because of the importance of finding a solution here, Ecology took an extra step and reached out recently to industry representatives and other agency staff to brainstorm potential alternative technical solutions. Meaning, were there some other procedures or other science that we should consider that would allow hemp matrix to be used as a surrogate? But we didn't find any, and based on those conversations, we feel we've exhausted those possible technical solutions. So it's only fair to say at this point that, again, putting on my ecology hat, that we're concerned whether or not the cannabis-based PTs will be available before we take on accreditation. So just a couple more slides. Next steps. The cannabis task force isn't done. There are some other fields of testing that we are working on to develop testing methods. So we're going to continue to work on microbial work, mycotoxins, and water activity and moisture. These remaining recommendations, it's too late for them to be documented in the report. So we will put them into a memo that we will send to the Liquor and Cannabis Board before the task force disbands. The Liquor and Cannabis Board and the Washington State Department of Agriculture also have a proposal to the governor's office for joint agency request legislation. It has not yet been approved for introduction by the governor's office in the 22 session. But what this proposal would do, it would do two things. It would transfer authority for the testing methods from the Liquor Cannabis Board to the Washington State Department of Ag, and it would form that regulatory oversight body that you heard about throughout this presentation. That oversight body is intended to have representatives of those two agencies as well as the Department of Health. And it would be responsible for providing interpretations and guidance on methods with built-in flexibility. It would be responsible for validating requests for changes to established methods, so current requests for flexibility. It would assist with coordination among agencies with different jurisdictions and, to the extent that it could coordinate an in-state cannabis proficiency or cannabis matrix proficiency process. Given what we've just shared about cannabis-based PTs, the task force sees that the oversight body playing an important role in developing these solutions and moving forward. So just the quick timeline of where we are, the task force was formed in 2019. And it has provided a series of recommendations to identify current and available science that can be adopted as new testing methods. However, this work, the task force has provided additional clarity on those details that were needed for implementation that were unforeseen in 2019. So the the implementation of this new direction will not be as simple as might have been initially envisioned. Rather than a simple transfer of authority and rulemaking to set a new fee schedule, the implementation now includes creation of a regulatory oversight body in order to handle the flexibility and the other list of responsibilities, as well as creation of the cannabis-based proficiency testing studies in order to achieve the desired results of accuracy, consistency among lads, and the improved consumer protections that we're looking for. And just to orient you to the 2024, the asterisk there indicates that with what we know now, successful implementation of Ecology's accreditation program, you know, is dependent on those elements being in place. So on behalf of the task force, I think we're on schedule, a little bit quicker than the 25 minutes allotted, but I do think that that's good in case you have questions and I'd like to have some discussion. So thank you for your time and for your support of this work.
Well, I really appreciate that, Dr. Hoffman. I do have a question, so I'll kick us off. I believe that I heard you saying that when we're doing some of the like setting up the protocols and the parameters for quality assurance, quality control, et cetera, we use a hemp based matrix. And I think you kind of talked a little bit about why that's not appropriate. I do think that if we're going to be assessing labs of how, you know, their proficiency on detecting the chemicals and substances present in any given sample of cannabis, we should really be setting all the standards according to cannabis. And so I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about if there's potentially a legislative fix that you see to the barriers to having a cannabis-based one. And I think you started leading to that discussion at the end of one of your previous slides, but is it that we don't have the opportunity to get hold of like the some standard samples of cannabis?
So great question. And I think that it really illustrates kind of the complexities of what we've been addressing. So the task force itself was focused primarily on content and the science of the work. But there's this companion component of implementation. And the PT work group that formed and the work that they did really kind of fell into more that implementation category. So the barriers that they came up against, so Oregon and there is a cannabis PT provider that does in matrix or in cannabis based PTs for Colorado and for Oregon. And we had actually brought him into Washington to give us a presentation on how that might work. So we were all very excited about that, but there were the way that the PT model works is they have to be able to sell their standards.
Okay.
And so that sort of got into that you know a more complicated field of, you know, what we can do with licenses and whatnot, and we just didn't have the ability to solve that with our focus on the content and the science.
Okay. So, you know, I think along the way in this journey of evolution in our cannabis market, we did create a research license. That was a new category that was not envisioned in 502. And I believe we have only granted one of those licenses, but it occurs to me that maybe there's a license that we could create so that the matrix and the standards could be sold for like a very narrow purpose. So anyway, that's an idea that popped into my head, and I look forward to future conversations about that. I think that one of the things that I stress over and over again is that the product needs to be safe and consumers need to know exactly what they're buying. So all of the work you're doing really points to that really crucial aspect. So thanks a lot for that. Anybody else have questions? Right. As I click through, I do not see any. So, okay, well, thank you again, Dr. Hoffman, and you can go ahead and close that out. Okay, so we seem to be pretty much on time, in fact, a little early. So we are going to next hear from the chair of the Problem Gambling Task Force. Julia Patterson is a commissioner, the gambling commissioner, and is the, like I said, the chair of the task force. And Roxanne Waldron is the program manager for the Problem Gambling program in the Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery at the Healthcare Authority. And they both have been doing a great deal of work on that. And I look forward to whatever you all are presenting. And I think broad timeline, I have you down on the schedule for 15 minutes, but I think you could go over a little bit. We're doing all right on time. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I practiced this in the mirror and it took 13 minutes. So I think it's perfect timing. So good afternoon, Chair Kloba and members of the committee. My name is Julia Patterson and I'm a commissioner with the Washington State Gambling Commission. And I also serve as the chair of the Problem Gambling Task Force. And Roxanne Waldron, the State Problem Gambling Program Manager, is also here as a resource today. And I wanted to let you know, I hope you aren't disappointed. We do not have a PowerPoint today, but we have some, what we think is a really good, interesting information. So I'm here today to give you an update on the work of the task force over this past year. As you may recall, a budget proviso was approved during the 2019 legislative session, and it initiated the Problem Gambling Task Force. And that task force began its work with an in-person meeting in January 2020 and has been meeting continually online during these past 22 months. So enacting this proviso, this is what you said. You said that you had concerns about the addictive nature of gambling, and you had a need to better understand the availability and quality of treatment and other problem gambling services in the state. And you also wanted the task force to look at how much the state and others are currently investing in prevention, awareness, education, outreach, recovery services, training for certified gambling counselors, and other service providers. And specifically, the legislature charged the task force with doing the following: collecting and reviewing past findings from state problem gambling studies, reviewing all existing programs and services that are currently being provided within our state borders, both state-funded and non-state-funded, and investigating what other states are providing, and if there's anything that we might learn from them. And finally, you want us to make recommendations back to you regarding the need for the expansion of services, what those funding needs might be, and how to increase the number of certified gambling counselors. So in order to provide data for our task force to understand the scope of this problem, the legislature appropriated $500,000 from the State Healthcare Authority's program gambling account in order to conduct an adult problem gambling prevalence study. The survey's data collection phase took place over this past summer. It opened in July and it closed in late September, and it was conducted by Washington State University's survey lab. And it met the goals with a 19.2% response rate and over 9,400 completed surveys. In this survey, questions were asked about types and frequency of gambling, co-occurring disorders, attitudes toward gambling, online gambling, as well as questions designed to screen for the severity of problem gambling. The findings from this prevalence study will be sent to the task force and to the legislature in June of 22. And these findings will then be incorporated and integral to the final report of the Problem Gambling Task Force due to you at the end of November 2022. As a reminder, this report was originally due in 2021, but due to COVID, the legislature gave the task force another year. So here's an update on the task force's work since January of 2020, and a look at where we are now and how the task force intends to approach this work during its last year together to completion. Since January of 2020, the task force has met 7 times, with the most recent meeting being held in September. The next one will be in January. In addition to the full task force, 4 work groups and a steering committee were formed in 2020 to address recommendations in the following areas. First, prevention and outreach. Second, access to care, treatment, and recovery. Third, research and data. And finally, advocacy and policy. Since January of 2020, the entire task force and its work groups have held over 50 meetings in total. The work groups, with the exception of the advocacy and policy group, completed their work in October, and the task force is now moving into the final phase of its work for 2022, and that will be data analysis and report writing. So here are a few, just to give you a taste of some of our work, here are a few possible recommendations the task force is considering for this final report coming to you in November next year. Examples are: increasing the number of certified gambling counselors in our state to meet expected demand. Second, increasing funding for prevention, outreach, awareness, and education and recovery support services, especially in those regions where these services currently are not available. Third, requiring periodic, mandatory, responsible gaming trainings for all staff and managers at commercial venues, because currently that training is just voluntary. And fourth, support for the Gambling Commission to work with all gambling operators to expand the new statewide voluntary self-exclusion program that will be coming online in 2022. Next, requiring that companies that design gambling products and machines include customer protection tools into all forms of gambling that give gamblers the ability to monitor their own behavior, their own gambling habits. So examples would be recommending that customers take a break and showing them how long they've been playing for, also showing them how much money they've spent. Another recommendation is to suggesting that the legislative work session, there be legislative work sessions about online and technology-based gaming and gambling. Information on these topics will be included in the final report to the legislature. There will be many other recommendations in our final report that I haven't mentioned today. So briefly, Madam Chair, I wanted to touch on some things that are changing about gambling in our state. I want to share with you several thought-provoking, trending issues that our task force is looking at that affect the need for services, both currently and into the future. First of all, legal sports wagering at tribal casinos. This past September, tribal casinos started rolling out legal sports wagering, and this expansion of gambling will most likely result in an additional need for treatment and other services. In response, to date, the tribes in our state have been agreeing to increase their internal funding for problem gambling. Although the tribes have acknowledged the necessity for this additional funding, at this point, the legislature has not yet identified a comparable state funding source to meet the anticipated increased need for treatment. And as a reminder, none of the tribal problem gambling funding is required to be sent to the state problem gambling account. That account is used primarily for funding treatment services. So the legislature might want to revisit state funding levels after receiving the final report of the task force next November. Another issue is the increase in the prevalence of online and mobile app gambling. Another factor that is likely to increase the need for services is the blurring of the lines between gaming and gambling. We've all seen the increase in the opportunities for online and mobile app gambling. Despite the fact that online gambling is not legal and it's not regulated or taxed in Washington state, many adults are actually illegally gambling, and they're playing these types of games online. They're playing video poker, video games, social casino games, social networking games, esports, mobile game apps, fantasy sports, and daily fantasy sports. In order to determine the prevalence of online and mobile app gambling in Washington state, the task force decided to include several questions about this topic in the prevalence study, and that information will be included in the prevalence study report that is due to you in June, as well as in the task force's final report due in November. A third issue that is trending is the issue of youth and online gambling. We also know that many young people are also playing games online and through mobile device apps. And young people frequently don't recognize when these games switch from simply gaming for fun to a form of gambling. The opportunities in these games to make in-app purchases, to buy loot boxes, to pay to level up, and other actions are some of the ways that game developers have figured out how to capture both money and time. So on the 2021 Healthy Youth Survey that the Department of Health is administering, there's a question that will illuminate what percentage of our young people are gambling and also have problems from gambling. And data from both the adult prevalence study and the 2021 Healthy Youth Survey will help inform our recommendations in our final report to you. And finally, the final issue I wanted to bring to your attention is the prevalence of problem gambling, the fact that the prevalence of problem gambling might be increasing. The preliminary data from the prevalence study suggests that during COVID, fewer people gambled, but for those who did gamble, a significantly higher percentage of them were at risk for addiction to gambling. So one challenge in analyzing the prevalence data will be untangling how much the pandemic itself has been a factor, both in the decrease in the number of adults gambling, along with the increased risk for gambling addiction of people who did gamble. So based on these and other factors, the task force may recommend that there be an increase in state funding for problem gambling treatment, for prevention, outreach, awareness, education, and also for clinical training. So finally, I guess, Madam Chair, today on behalf of the task force, I want to thank you. Thank you for your involvement. You've been a very important force through this process and are very much appreciated. And thanks for this opportunity to give a briefing to the committee. Roxanne Waldron, as I said earlier, is here, and we're both happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I actually do have a question for Roxanne. I think you're, you have one foot in the specific problem gambling behavioral health segment, but I think you also have some expertise in the larger behavioral health perspective. And so I think it's not any surprise to anyone that we are having, you know, a workforce shortage. There is a lot more need for behavioral health services than we have the ability to provide in this state. And that, you know, is, I'm sure, the same when it comes to problem gambling. So are you seeing, like, when those conversations happen about behavioral health, are you seeing people kind of recognizing that problem gambling treatment is a part of that? I think sometimes it kind of gets left to the side, but what are your observations there?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. It's a great question. As you know, because you've been involved with the Problem Gambling Task Force also, is that problem gambling in Washington State tends to be siloed, and that's the case in many states across the country. And so part of my work with working within HCA is to work with other units, like our prevention unit and others on our adult treatment unit, team that I'm on, to help educate them around the issues of problem gambling and also around the issues of workforce. I do know that working closely with the Evergreen Council on Problem Gambling, which is our nonprofit partner in the state, that they have seen an increase in the number of gambling counselors they've been able to certify in the last year. So that's a positive.
Fantastic. I'm glad to see that moving in the right direction. Any other questions, comments from members? All right, well, seeing none, I will thank the both of you for joining us and sharing this information. Really appreciate the work you're doing. And all righty, so next we have our fourth and final panel today from the University of Washington's Addictions, Drug, and Alcohol Institute, which is often, it's a mouthful, so you'll hear ADAI as the acronym there. And we have Dr. Beatrice Carlini, as well as Dr. Susan Ferguson. And I imagine that they will give themselves an introduction, so I won't belabor that, but we're really happy to have you with us. So go ahead and start.
Thank you. Let me see if I can share my slides here. I usually make some kind of, can you see anything there?
Not yet.
Okay.
Don't worry, we have some time.
Yeah. Let's see, so show us taskbar. Okay, hold on just a second. Yeah, I know what I did. Okay. Taking a deep breath right now. Okay. So, okay, so
hey, now you are screen sharing, but it's your entire
My entire life. Yeah. So here we go.
Don't worry, we can't see what tabs you have open.
Okay, so now you can see just the slide or the slides in my notes.
With your notes, presenter mode.
Okay. So let me just change that to the different monitor. Should be able to change to the other. That sounds familiar to you, right, Susan?
Yeah, I think that'll work. And while you're working on that, I'll just introduce myself really quick. Thanks, Representative Kloba and the committee for giving us this opportunity. My name is Susan Ferguson. I'm the director of ADAI, and really Dr. Carlini, who's one of our research scientists, is going to be giving you the presentation today. So I'm just kind of here to support her and be available for questions.
Oh, we are in business now, Dr. Carlini.
There we go. I knew. Thanks.
I knew you did.
Thanks, Susan. Yeah, so I'm Bia Carlini. I do lead the research, cannabis research and education program at ADAI. And thanks, Representative Clover, Madam Chair, for bringing us here. It's always a pleasure to be here. So I'm basically, per request, giving a proviso update on the developing policy solutions in response to the public health challenges of high THC potency cannabis. In this brief update, we'll cover ADAI mandate related to this project or to this proviso, the progress to date, and the next steps. So a little bit of about ADAI mandate. We were directed to through healthcare authority to contract, to explore policy solutions in response to the public health challenges to high THC. In this contract, through healthcare authority, we have to submit an initial report summarizing the progress to date. So we are 40 days into this report, and what I'm gonna bring today is a little bit of what we are gonna present in the report as well, with less details, of course. And we have 18 months total. So in 2022, we're gonna summarize to the legislators we're gonna do in terms of policy recommendations, including an inventory of relevant cannabis policies in other places of the United States and Canada, and also how we have involved stakeholders to find solutions that work for Washington State in terms of the challenges of high THC content in cannabis products. I want to reiterate, and never, it seems to be enough, that we really are, our mandate does not include medicinal cannabis. We are talking here about non-medical commercial cannabis. We recognize that medicinal users have specific needs and work in partnership with their clinicians, and the concerns related to high potency THC does not apply in this case and is not in our scope of work. We also wanna remind you all in the research brief that you can see there is part of the package that you received today, that what we are doing on looking at policy solutions is a natural next step in terms of work we did in 2020, that was basically an initiative of Healthcare Authority 2 through the Washington Prevention Research Subcommittee, PRSC. And we all worked, both University of Washington and WSU, on putting together a work group that during 6 months analyzed data in terms of cannabis concentration and health risks. We produced then a consensus statement and also a report that we give it today. The package is the research brief on this report, and where we concluded after looking at the research available that there was a clear dose response relationship where the highest the THC content was in cannabis products, the higher the risk of encountering adverse health effects. These risks were not in general, they were particularly concerning for young users and people with pre-existing mental health conditions. And we also found that, and we documented this in Washington State, that the harm seems to be more likely to affect, disproportionately affect affected marginalized populations like low income and minorities, in part because these products tend to have a lower cost and that they are easy to use for a discrete nature, and also through the glamorization through social media and advertising. So for that very reason, our mandate through this proviso is not to do research and do and bring more evidence. This evidence was documented previously, but rather use our skills as scientists to develop policy solutions in response to the public health challenges of such products. This in the scope of work included conducted interviews with stakeholders and experts and identified areas of common ground and consensus. And through this process, develop recommendations for state policies related to cannabis potency with the goal of mitigating detrimental health impacts. So with that background, what have we done? And I want to point out that this is just 4.5 months of work. So bear with us, it's an 18-month process. To date, we have identified some policies that were proposed and adopted in North America. And I want to emphasize we identified policies. By no means we are recommending them at that stage. We are just listing what has been proposed. We also have identified stakeholders and experts in different buckets or different types and define the approach we are going to work with these stakeholders to bring a fair assessment of what is of policy solutions we'll recommend. So in terms of, again, in 40 days, we're going to have access to the full report in more detail, but some of the policies we are mentioning and without suggesting them is, for instance, familiar to us all here in Washington State, taxation based on THC concentration, so in weight or percentage, prohibiting certain types of products that by nature are higher in THC. So this policy has been proposed or been adopted in North America. Limit a total THC in a single purchase. Regulating packaging and labeling in the same way that some, you know, you have information on food, on really knowing the degree or the unit of intoxication in the package and the labeling. In combination with requiring a serving size, we know edibles in Washington State require a serving size. This is not the case for other products. Capping THC concentration in any in any product, different from prohibiting certain product types. Another policy being discussed is requiring a minimum of CBD content. As some of you may know, that CBD does buffer some of the intoxicating effects of THC. So by balancing the rate, that could be maybe help to mitigate the effects. And also thinking about regulating or prohibiting marketing, either of this particular product, the high THC content, or in general. Regulate, of course, we have regulation here, but it'll be more about being more stringent or prohibiting. So these are in our report that in 40 days will be available, makes a more detailed account of this and where they have been used and with some very light comments on the pros and cons because it's really the part of the stakeholders that are gonna have a more important effect. So our recommendation of policies are related to what's been done in other parts, but mostly also about what stakeholders in our state think. So at this point, we have defined in general the classes of stakeholders we are gonna consult. I wanna bring to the attention that, of course, although not considered stakeholders because they are sovereign nations, will also reach, are in the process of reaching out to Washington State tribe leadership to get their perspective as well. And this means in community, we are considering cannabis consumers, both medical and non-medical, mental health advocates, mental health patients, historical marginalized groups, health experts go from clinicians to researchers to healthcare agencies, prevention agencies or prevention agents, cannabis industry. We are including farmers, processors, retail, lobbying organizations, and media dedicated and funded by cannabis industry. At this point, we are in a process of constantly doing an inventory. Our inventory in this, it's about 42 organizations, and we have around 120 people that will have so far listed as stakeholders. What we are going to do with stakeholders being agency or individuals. So it's a two-step approach, and the main common denominator of these two steps is that basically we are going to listen and listen and listen. And we are going to listen stakeholders in two ways. First, through interviews, about 35 to 40 people will be selected to get their in-depth perspective of the issues about high THC products and possible possible policies. And also we are going to talk to people with lived experience or representing collective interests of people with lived experience that may have experienced problems with high THC products. And in a second moment, we are going to do a concept mapping. So this is a process that has been used by several organizations on involving people to choose policies. Is a way, it allows for a participatory approach that is very equitable in the sense that everybody can give anonymous input and allows for ample participation. So here we are talking about hundreds of people that are going to have ability to, through an online process they're going to present in a moment, participate on helping to decide what is right for Washington State. Our role is as a scientist is to be on the background, synthesizing data that we collect, analyzing areas of convergence of possible consensus in terms of policy, and help to rate according to the perspective of stakeholders, how important, feasible, and equitable are the different policies suggested. So in a very, very brief way, so this concept mapping, again, is an online process where you are able to capture collective thinking through helping to participants to brainstorm whatever goes to their mind as possible solutions for the issue of high potency or highly concentrated cannabis products. So in a first moment is a process of brainstorming solutions and without having any hierarchy on them. And on a second phase, after we as an institute help to organize all the collective, capture all the collective thoughts and ideas about it, we bring them back and ample participation again, where people can rate the policy suggestions. Are they important to you? Are they even feasible? Are there any concern that this policy is equitable? So it's not from academicians analyzing the data, but it's stakeholders telling us what is important to them, what is feasible to them, what is equitable to them, and we are going to organize them this information. So these things were defined, started, and now we have 13 to 14 months ahead of us. We are going to continue during this time. We just barely started to work with stakeholders. They are the bulk of the work we are doing, but we also are going to inform our recommendations, again, by looking more in depth to the context, policy initiatives and programs that are taking place in North America. By no means, Washington State is the only state concerned with highly concentrated cannabis products. So we have a lot to learn from other states. And we are also gonna take the opportunity to dive more into the local assessment of what is happening here. So there are things being published. We wanna get a little more what is actually happening on the ground from acute health events. And to also, we wanted to be able to assess what is For a lot of times, we've been we heard that one of the issues of regulating high potency cannabis products is the possibility of the informal market then start producing and then cause fires and explosions because of the unregulated way of producing this product. So we wanted to assess whether or not this seems to be a possibility considering the past for the regulated market now, and also document better mental health events that happen in our community. Wrapping up, just to remind, the focus of policy recommendations to be made through this work is on retail, on medical cannabis. This is what we are presented here is like 4 months of work. The scope of work that we are now in hands is a natural extension of what was already documented in 2020 through the initiative with Washington State scientists, and that ADAI will work by making policy recommendations as requested by the legislators, utilizing a participatory and equitable approach. We want to do these policy recommendations informed by the voices heard in the stakeholder analysis process. So that will be it. I'm going to stop share. So much.
Okay, great. I appreciate that because that does make it easier for me to see if any of my members have their hands raised. Okay. I'm going to go first again. And big surprise, the chair has a question. In this process, as you're deciding on policy solutions, and I do understand that that's still down the road and there are many steps before you get there, but at some point you'll determine what are the criteria by which you will evaluate the policy solutions, I imagine. Is that okay? I see a head nod. Good. And then I guess this isn't maybe as much a question as I hope that something you mentioned is the impact on the illicit market. I hope that that will be one of your areas that you think about and evaluate any potential policy solution, because it would be you know, antithetical to what you're trying to do if any regulation we do on the legal market pushes people into the unregulated market. And so does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good questions and comments. Yeah, absolutely. So first, it's our hope that our the suggestions and recommendations that are going to be made are really not ADAI, but much more as ADAI facilitating the voice and the considerations of Washington stakeholders and communities. So we are going to use this mapping process that basically organize different opinions and find areas of consensus through analysis of data. So you can find where there are what we call go zones. So where there is some consensus and where there is no way there is consensus. So we are going to recommend options that are feasible because there are some support and they are considered important and acceptable. So and in terms of the illicit market, yeah, has been a very common argument in terms of advancing on policy in this area. And we hope to illuminate a little bit. Nobody really can totally guess what will happen as we had so many surprises since legalization. But we want to take in consideration this possibility, see if we have examples in other places, and also see what experts and stakeholders consider in terms of possible effects.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, we have a question from Representative Chambers. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clova. Dr. Carlini, will there be surveys or anything that we can help distribute or participate in or share with our constituents?
Great question. Thank you. So what would be, it looks like a survey. What I described is this online survey process. And yes, please, you have my email, my contact. We will be interested of you sending people our way to be able to see if they want to participate. Absolutely. We are in a process of making lists, and we'll be interested in getting people that have a say and interest in this area.
Great, thank you.
Yes, well, I do appreciate that question, and I definitely look forward to partnering with you and ADAI to really tackle this problem and come up with some good solutions. I think there is, it's not an easy issue to resolve, but it is absolutely necessary that we do. So, all right, I am not seeing any other questions. So, unless I'm seeing no opposition, I am going to go ahead and adjourn us for the day. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. Bye now.